So I'm basically just going to run through some basic sort of the concepts of the insurance. Obviously, you all know how to insure your car, so it's not like I'm going to teach you about that. The market activities, in-orbit satellites, launch vehicle stats, recent in-orbit failures, and premium rates. And then I'll go on to look at a couple of other things, the worldwide premium and losses I thought you might be interested in, and the worldwide market capacity. Some issues that have sort of come up for us in our market, and a little bit of a conclusion on where we're perhaps going to from here. Just briefly, the types of areas that are covered for insurance, the pre-launch phase, that includes the actual manufacture of the satellite. When a satellite costs $200 million to build, then the manufacturer's got a lot of exposure, if you like, while it's being built. So if anything happens, and a couple of classic illustrations of that have been, you may recall McDonnell Douglas was loading an Indian satellite on top of a Delta and a hook fell. The cable let go. It hadn't been certified for a while and the hook fell down and landed on the top of the satellite. The satellite was shipped back to San Francisco. While it was there, an earthquake hit San Francisco. And about $15 million damage in total was done to the satellite. They had to do a fair bit of work. So that traditionally is covered not by people like ourselves, but in what they call the marine insurance market. It used to be covered in the space market, and the marine people thought it was good businesses, so they came in and cut the rates. Then the launch program or insurance aspect really covers from intentional ignition, and pre-launch comes up until the point of intentional ignition. The launch policy then takes over. Obviously with launch vehicles like, say, Ariane 4, where you can turn it off until the moment you light the solids, you've got a different point of intentional ignition, and you can actually end up covering, and we do end up covering terminated ignitions on occasion. There was one case some years ago where the Indians, coincidentally, had gone, there was a difference between the pre-launch cover and the launch cover. And one was the moment of liftoff and one was intentional ignition, and there was sort of like a 4-second gap, which they paid something like 1% of the value of the satellite to insure. Post-separation, once you're in orbit, released from the launch vehicle, including deployments and in-orbit tests and commissioning. And then the third phase is typically the sort of early period following that, maybe 180 days to a year, although that is stretching out to something like 2, 3, and 5 years at the moment, all under the same launch policy. Continuing on then, once it's all, as it were, past the launch phase cover, then there's the in-orbit phase. And that can apply to both the satellite itself. The operator may insure the satellite because it's an asset for them. If they lose that, then they're really stuck dead in the water with nothing to provide income. It could be on the individual transponder. Somebody leases a transponder on a satellite. They therefore have some exposures separately. Or it could be something like the Olympics. If anything was to go wrong with that satellite during that time, you're not going to get a second bite of the cherry for another 4 years. It's like you've got big expenses. The other area that is covered, not so much by us, but for the launch activities, you recall the Delta failure earlier this year, a rather spectacular firework shortly after liftoff. That was covered by third-party liability. The Chinese have made an unfortunate habit of dropping bits of rockets onto people, and that's also been covered by third-party liability cover. And then some countries actually require, the British require, that any satellite that's in orbit is actually insured for in-orbit liability in case it hits something else. Now, when we're talking geosynchronous satellites, of course, that's an awful long way away, and you would have thought fairly remote. A little bit different story with a LEO satellite, but just a sort of a bit of a summary of what's been happening in the market principally this year. So far in 1997, we've seen 28 geosynchronous satellites launched. All but three carried some form of insurance, most of them covered full. In the case of that Delta launch that I mentioned, that was only insured for the launch vehicle itself. The satellite was a military program and not insured specifically. There have been 51 non-geosynchronous launches, which includes three failures, that Delta that I mentioned, carrying the GPS, a Zenit failed, and you probably read of the Brazilian VLS launched recently, only survived for about 60 seconds. Most, except for the Iridium and the Delta of the non-geosynchronous, are not actually insured, although the Iridium program is fully insured, but it's in an interesting structure where it's launch phase only, then the in-orbit, then other parts as well. And as I say there, we've got 39 Iridium satellites have been launched so far, five on five deltas each, and then two lots of seven on a Proton. In orbit, we're talking about 153 or so, the stats were a little bit harder to come by, communication satellites, not really covering military or peculiarly scientific satellites that may be in the geosynchronous ring. And 91 of those are covered for some form of in-orbit cover, and sort of excluding the ones that have maybe just been launched, so they're still under the launch cover. Iridium satellites are also being insured for their full lifetime, basically, of 5 to 7 years. And then just to quickly update you, how did NNH go over there? Shows you what happens when you don't have time. Briefly update the stats on what happened with each of the launch vehicles. You may recall, those of you who were here 5 years ago, that I did a similar thing showing the failure rates. I've put this into a little different order, though. Proton has launched 251 times. Unfortunately, I don't have the stats for Soyuz, which claims to be both the most reliable and to have launched the most times by far. Something like 600 launches, I believe. But we can see
98%.
They do, exactly. All launches for Proton, we're approaching 11.5% reliability or success rate, in fact, and 8.5 for geosynchronous. Now, what I've done is I've included the development phase, which they don't count really about the first 23 or 30 launches up until 1970. And quite a high proportion of those, as you can see, were failures. They claim a somewhat higher reliability rate. But to be consistent, I do them all from scratch. Delta, 250 launches, 5.6 as opposed to, 11.5. So it's basically twice as reliable over its full life. And for the geosynchronous, it's only slightly more reliable, in fact, at 7 instead of 8.5. Then the next most used vehicle to date has been the Titan. For a little while it was looking as if it would be used commercially, but they had a lot of trouble winning contracts. And when they put Intelsat into the, left it attached to its rocket motor, it didn't help their cause any. And you can see there that they're almost reversed. Because it's really a vehicle that's really just a launch vehicle to put somebody into orbit, and then somebody comes along and says, well, I want this rocket motor and this satellite to do something else. They're actually much worse on the geosynchronous, nearly double the previous ones. But overall, fairly good reliability. Atlas is the next most utilised to date on commercial, and this is the Atlas Centaur variation rather than all of the Atlases, which is something like 500 vehicles. And we're looking at a fairly similar range, but as you can see, it's a little bit higher than Delta. In fact, quite a bit higher, nearly double overall Delta, but you're talking nearly half the number of vehicles as well. Ariane, on the other hand, being optimised for geosynchronous, you would expect and hope, and it proves that, in fact, it is quite reliable in the geosynchronous and, in fact, all launch case. So it's pretty much up there with the best of them. The Chinese, then, have had their run of fun, so to speak, and overall they're not too bad. I attribute both the Optus B2 launch failure and the Apstar 2R to the launch vehicle, although I firmly also believe that Hughes was a major contributor and that the combination of the satellite with the motor that they had led to an oscillation that shouldn't really have happened if they'd done their own couple nodes analysis properly and things like that. But nonetheless, that vehicle, that satellite, it appears to be more related to the vehicle. The Japanese have had a pretty good success rate with really only one failure. But they've launched considerably fewer times, but they're very, very reliable to date. And then just to encourage those of you, I haven't really changed this because the last time I presented it 5 years ago, there's only been one Scout launch since. And a little bit like the Proton launch vehicle, if you look at how many launches they went, they're, you know, past 30, and they're still averaging 2 out of 5 as failures. Now, I'm sure that the ASRI venture will be much more successful than that, but others that went for a lot longer have done worse. Just some recent in-orbit failures. Some of these you may have heard of, others don't always sort of make the general press, so you may not have come across. Anik E1 had a major failure back in March of last year. It was insured for $150 million and basically a total loss was paid out for that. It was hit prior to that with some electronics problems with the ground loop. The momentum wheel electronics were taken out by something like a single event upset or some form of other interruption. And then they had a total loss of control for a while there. And they have, in fact, recovered that and using a system of what they call ground-controlled uplink, where basically they send the signal up through the main transponders, check that it's maximum strength, and just keep it positioned by that. There's no momentum wheels anymore, basically. Spot 3, you probably know of, failed late last year. Telstar 401 failed suddenly and without warning in January of this year. Really no satisfactory explanation. It appears that perhaps a massive short occurred on one of the buses and that just led to a flow-on tumble effect that wiped out everything else. JCSAT 1 was finally turned off in February of this year, but in fact it started a slow fuel leak back in August 95, and the market paid about $25 million for that loss. Tempo 2 is strictly under the launch policy, as is Pan Am Sat 6, but they've got new technology. They've got gallium arsenide cells, and there's some problem with these particular arrays, and they've lost about 5 strings on Tempo 2, and they're rapidly following in the footsteps with Pan Am Sat 6. An instance of where new technology has appeared to be tested adequately on Earth, but once you get it into the space environment. And one of the things about testing solar cells is, in most cases, you can only do a flash test. It's not like you can do the sustained charge type testing. The sun's pretty hard to simulate. InSat 2D also failed earlier this month. A short again took out one of the buses, and they ended up being unable to control it sufficiently. Combination of thermal and electrical power there, though, being the issue. The premium rates. Well, the pre-launch has traditionally been considerably less than 1%, but because it's an area that we're not involved with, I can't be more specific than about less than 1%. It's something like 0.1 to 0.3, I think, at the moment, depending on the vehicle and where you're launching from. Chinese must be getting a bit expensive, though. Launch plus early orbit, which is the sort of traditional launch cover we talk about, has seen a tremendous variation. Some of the Long March launch vehicles this year have effectively had a 32% failure premium rate. Now, it hasn't actually been paid in that way. What they've paid is up front something like 25 or 26. And then if it had have been a failure, the additional premium would have just been deducted off the loss. So they would have only got back 68% of the value of the satellite plus launch vehicle cost. In-orbit rates vary considerably depending on a not very healthy satellite, for instance, or one with a lot of new technology that nobody's very confident in. Could be something around 4% per annum, and the really well-known ones like the Hughes 376s and even the Hughes 601s now are starting to come down to 1.5 or maybe a little bit lower. The worldwide premium losses, basically we're looking at this over the last few years. It's actually been quite a good period for the underwriters. 94 was a pretty bad year. 96 was a bit line ball. This is not strictly accurate also because I've done it on the basis of what we call underwriting years, which means that the policy might have actually been last year's policy, but the failure happened this year because that's when the launch was or something like that. So it could be a little bit different. But overall, it's not been too bad a period. If we took out the Chinese, it probably would have been excellent. The worldwide market capacity, and that's not to be derogatory of our Chinese friends, it's just the reality of what's happened for them. You can see that this is called the period of innocence, because what happened there was that underwriters were believing engineers. Engineers kept saying, this is really reliable, not going to be any worries, the shuttle's so reliable, you know, it'll never fail, it'll fly, and, you know, all these sorts of things. So people were willing to go along with that thinking. And being an engineer myself, I can understand that, of course. And it really sort of, it got to a point where people were charging much too low a premium. Even at that point, the historical failure rates were up around 15 to 20%. And they were being charged premiums of something like 4 and 5% for a shuttle launch. And then, of course, Westar and Palapa failed to... the PAMDs blew their nozzles off, so they didn't go very far away from the shuttle. A few things like that. One of the satellites was misloaded at Arianespace in Kourou, and it span with a wobble, so it didn't really go quite as far as it should have gone either. And there was really just a run of failures. The correction had actually occurred before the worst run of failures, which was in 86, when both Challenger blew up, Atlas failed, Ariane failed, Titan failed, Delta failed. It was almost like somebody had sabotaged the Western world. But it wasn't, of course. It was just one of those coincidences, you know, that all come together. But the correction had started to occur in the insurance market, and what happened at that point was that the insurance rates, which had been around about the sort of below 10% mark and maybe around 4%, went up to 25 to 30%. Possibly a bit of an overcorrection. And now we're seeing that as the failure rates have sort of started to improve a bit, that's come down. And along with that has gone an increase in market capacity. One of the other reasons for the increase in the capacity is that a lot of other classes of insurance business are not doing as well as space. So people look at the results from the space market and think, oh, that's good, let's put some money in there and see whether we can make some. But that's contributing to some of the issues that we're facing. One of which is that we are in a competitive environment. When we started out as the Space Insurance Group, we were providing about 3% of the worldwide capacity back in 89, whereas now our capacity is less than 1%, and many others, including one company that helped us in the beginning called Generali, an Italian company, they have a capacity of $110 million on their own. And they put down $70 million on the most recent Chinese Long March launch, just as a single line. So he was very pleased to hear when I told him that it was successful. Can't understand why. Some of the issues that I'm being asked about and that are basically real issues. Year 2000, most of you will have heard about that, and you probably know a lot more about it than I do, actually. Most of you are more electronically inclined. It appears that for the satellites, though, it's probably less of an issue because most of the satellites are dumb. They really, the electronics is very, very simple. They are also reprogrammable from the ground. There's very little intelligence on board, so to speak, and what little there is can be reprogrammed. So the satellite itself appears, in at least a broad brush sense, to be relatively safe. They also tend to work on relative time rather than absolute times. Or if they do work on a year, it's only year to year. They go from 1 January till 31st of December because you want to program in that on such and such a date something happens. But it doesn't care whether it was this year, last year, next year, or 10 years down the track. And likewise, in many cases, it's basically got a clock running that as soon as it starts, that's it. You know, it just runs until it's the end of life. Different issue with the ground stations, probably, because they're more ground-based PCs, obviously. But again, you can do things like you can simulate. Most operators have got a computer-based simulator of the satellite itself, so you can put it into the ground station and check it out. Leonids in the other meteor showers appear to be a real potential problem, although the 98 revisit of the Leonids meteor storm would appear to be probably of a lesser magnitude than the 1966 visit. But there are a lot more satellites there now than there were at that time, so it could be a real issue. And the solar maximum, coming up to another 11-year cycle, and I think 2000-2001 sort of time frame, could be an issue, but again, the more satellites, are they more sensitive or less sensitive? We're not quite sure on that point. So finally, in conclusion, I think we can say that the market capacity is more than adequate to cover virtually any risk. Funnily enough, 5 years ago, no, the early 90s, they were talking about the value of an Ariane launch with two satellites, Ariane 5 launch, two large value satellites, $500 million. No way we can achieve that sort of capacity. And at that stage, it was basically about double what was available. Now, of course, we can easily do it if it was a suitable rating and what have you. Nobody puts down the full capacity, though, typically, so, you know, they might have $110 million, but as I said, $70 million was big enough. So virtually the majority of activities can be covered. Could be a different story with regard to the space station. If that was to be fully insured, then obviously that would be beyond the capacity, so not adequate in that sense. There is pressure on the premium rates, and the extent of cover is becoming more broad. As I said before, traditionally it's sort of been 180 days to a year after launch. Now we're looking at 2 to 3 years and even 5 years. And then, of course, one of the things that is becoming increasingly exciting is some of the Australian projects that could come to reality. I should have added Ares. I think I meant to write Ares there instead of FIDSAT, but because it was more of a commercial nature. But IRC with their sort of launch vehicle type proposals, Kitcom and Kistler, and Ares and Optus C1. And our own capacity as an Australian market has grown now to the point where we could actually take almost 25% of a risk, which is an exciting place to be in. Whether we want to be there or not is another matter. And I thought I just might quickly mention a couple of other statistics. The total losses, the total premium cumulatively since it began is something like about $5.5 billion, with paid losses of about $4.5 billion to date. Small offset for recovery, so the net losses is about 4.3. Just for this year alone, the premium income, discounting and allowing for the losses that I mentioned already, plus a couple others that you wouldn't have heard about because two Iridiums have gone missing, or at least not responding to anything. They know where they are, of course, but they're just not responding or moving where they should do. We're looking at about $630 million has been generated at this point so far this year. Well, that compares with that's a net result after the losses, so there's sort of like $800 million in premium, about $180 worth of losses. That compares with last year with premium of about $500 million worth of losses and $225 as the net result. So there's pretty big numbers floating around in the space insurance market, and the whole marketplace is sort of growing at a fairly rapid pace.